Hi, welcome to another episode of Better Off Red. I'm Pip Adam. Hilarity is ensuing here as I try and record this introduction. I always have this precarious, I don't have a microphone stand and I just dropped my recorder. That was exciting. Anyway, welcome to the Moby Dick episode. Pretty excited about this. Promise I won't make a call me Pip joke. I spoke to David Fleming, who you can read about on the website. He's an incredible writer and incredible reader. And we talked about Moby Dick a couple of weeks back. I was a bit nervous about this conversation. I kind of had this feeling that maybe everything that needed to be said about this book had been said about this book. And it turns out not. It turns out, I don't know, it was kind of an exciting it was an exciting conversation because it made me realise that, as with all books, I suppose, that this book has as many readings as it has readers. And it was so great to talk to David about it. He's a Bostonian. He also really likes whales. So he just is one of the most perfect people to talk about this. And he really, his take on it is just so interesting. He managed to bring in Star Trek and a whole bunch of other things. It was just a wonderful conversation. And you'll notice a difference in the recording. The recording's always different because we always record it in different places, but this episode was recorded in Lawrence Patchett's writing shed. I'm not actually even sure if Lawrence Patchett knows that we recorded it in his writing shed. We didn't break in or anything. I'm sure it's all going to be cool. But Lawrence Patchett has a shed that he writes in, and as you can imagine, it's not the sturdiest of structures. And we recorded this on a day when the wind was just blowing 10,000 degrees. So what happens is that throughout the recording, you'll hear wind. You'll hear trees knocking against the shed. You'll hear cars kind of rushing by through wet streets. There's rain. It was a really full-on day, which was kind of exciting. It felt a bit like being in a boat. Hopefully it will just add to the excitement of Moby Dick for you. I think it's absolutely impossible to give spoilers about this book. It's about a whale. There's a chapter about the colour white. There's a lot of information about whales. You don't need to worry about that, but you should read it anyway. It's a great summer read. I just also wanted to put in a bit of a plug, while I've got your attention, for an event that Carl Shuker and I are doing next Thursday, the 30th of October, at the Preservatorium at 39 Webb Street. Now, you will need to book for it. You can't just turn up. What we're doing is we're having sort of a discussion. We're trying to facilitate a discussion rather than us talking and people listening, or us reading and people listening. What we want to try and do is get people to talk to each other and to us, and we're hoping that we can, get that conversation going by starting a discussion between ourselves. Anyway, so the event is called You've Got to Sell Your Heart, and what we're hoping to do is start a conversation about risk in writing. It's $35 for a ticket, and that includes your dinner, and it's a really nice dinner. Kirsten LaHaravel is organising it, and she's organising it on behalf of Kahini, which is a really interesting organisation. I will put all that information on the blog so you can have a look at it. And ahoy. And I hope you enjoy the discussion with Dave, and I'll catch up with you soon. Bye. Okay. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Pip.
Hey. We're in a shed at the moment, and you might be able to hear rain on the roof and cars driving by, and the wind might whistle. It seems like the perfect place to talk about Moby Dick. We're actually in Lawrence Patchett's shed, which is very nice as well. Nice of him to lend it to us. That's fantastic. So, Dave.
Nah.
Moby Dick. Now, I am just looking at my copy of Moby Dick, which I got at a second-hand store for $5.50. It's not a very impressive-looking copy. I had it for years before I read it. I started it several times, and it was you that talked me into reading it.
Oh, wow.
And the reason was that you told me a story. We were talking one day, and you told me a story about Melville in a cave on a stormy day, and how that meeting kind of maybe changed the direction of this book. And I was just wondering if you just wanted to start off by talking a little bit about that story.
Sure. It's one of my favorite stories, and sort of one of my favorite stories about any novel. And it concerns Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne, his sort of great contemporary and briefly really intense friend. Mm. And so basically, Melville, he had written two books that were really, really successful. Two books about his time in the, I think it was the Marquesan Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty big bestsellers for the era. And then he wrote two other novels that were really unsuccessful. And so as he was writing Moby Dick, he had moved to Western Massachusetts, to the Berkshires. And he was living in an old farmhouse out there. And he heard from some friends one day that Nathaniel Hawthorne was in town. I guess Bostonians at the time would summer in the Berkshires to get away from the city and the heat. And so he had never met Hawthorne before. And one day, as he was writing his draft of Moby Dick, Melville wrote like a novel every year. He was like Lawrence Fernley in that regard, where it's like a novel every year, which is amazing, considering the length of some of them. But so as he was writing Moby Dick, he somehow ended on a hike with Nathaniel Hawthorne, and the detail, the accounts of sort of what that meeting were like, there's a few secondhand accounts of like what that conversation was like between those two people, but it seems like it was one of those moments where two people sort of recognized in the other person, kindred spirit, and it became this sort of intense conversation. Aided a little bit by a big thunderstorm that rolled in halfway through their hike that forced the hiking group into a cave somewhere. And apparently this is sort of, as that thunder is crashing outside, Melville and Hawthorne are inside crashing ideas against each other. And after he wrote that, after that happened, Melville wrote a review of Hawthorne's latest novel, which was a novel I've never read called... something about the old manse, something at the old manse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of Hawthorne's bigger, more famous novels, but Melville wrote a wonderful review of it, and he's talking about how it's really ambitious, and the purpose of being a writer is to be really ambitious, and you can sort of read in Moby Dick a transition taking place in which the novel, Melville's own approach to that novel becomes much more ambitious than I think it sort of is suggested in the earlier chapters. Like, the early chapters have this sort of, like, comic, jovial, I'm going on an adventure, my spleen hurts, and so I'm going to go see the sea and be, be an adventurer on the ocean, have goofy adventures with Queequeg in the old Spouters Inn, and then it becomes this, like, serious, serious epic of blood and violence and religious ferocity, the reason I love that story is because I love the idea of, as writers, we sort of sit in our own houses, working on our own work, and it's a sort of lonely, isolating experience. It's why I'm always jealous of musicians, because they can work collaboratively. The act of being in a band is this wonderful collaborative experience, whereas the act of writing a novel is this lonely, solitary moment. And so I love this idea that, like, these two people engaged in solitary processes found each other and found ways to sort of motivate each other towards great things. This is why Melville dedicated the book to Hawthorne, because he felt like that those conversations he had with Hawthorne pushed him towards writing the hardest book he could write. I think it's really cool. I don't know what happened to their relationship after that. Like, apparently they were really intense friends, and then it completely collapsed. It's really strange, and I don't know why that was the case. But and of course it was a failure of a novel. It completely bombed. And then he wrote another novel that was even crazier, and that that was the novel that, like, the reviewers were like, is Melville insane? I think one of the New York, like, big reviews was, I'm worried about his mental state. He needs to be checked into a hospital and not be allowed to write. So yeah, Melville's career was sort of destroyed after this, and and he died an anonymous, unknown writer.
Because I really like what you say about him writing the hardest book he could write, and I don't even know if this is a question that can be answered, but I do wonder what, there is a book, I guess, latently in history which does carry on from those first chapters and does romp around and keep romping, and I just wonder what, this craziness of structure, this real ambition, like, how do you push yourself to do that? Like, I mean, do you think, I think I asked you this once before, do you think he realized how confrontational the book was when he was writing it, or how against everything that was sitting comfortably, do you think he had any idea about the reception the book would have?
I don't know if he thought it would sort of break any ground in the broader literary universe, but I do think he realized that he was, embarking on something that wasn't going to be, like, I think there was that tension of, do I write the books that made me money early in my career and made me famous early in my career, or do I write a book that's really hard? And I think that was it was a moment of, like, I'm at the midpoint of my career, I've got a couple kids, I've got a house that I have to pay for. Like, what am I going to do? Like, where am I going to go with my career? Am I going to sell out and write another book about, Tahitian beauties and my love affairs with them? Or am I going to write a book that sort of touches on the sort of more profound darkness of the soul? Mm. And I do think he sort of, I read it as a sort of, as an author choosing the sort of more difficult path.
Yeah.
But I don't know sort of, yeah, I don't know how he thought the rest. I imagine he thought the rest of the world would praise it. I think he did have high ambitions that, like, he would be recognized for his genius. I mean, his next novel was even crazier in a lot of ways, and so I think he really did want, some degree of recognition. Mm. But
because I think that's what's weird as a writer in relationship to this book is that. God. Not that I think I'm ever going to write Moby Dick, but, there is that weird kind of hindsight thing, like, when people are shying away from work that you're writing, or are sort of, like, not understanding it, or that kind of thing, there is always that weird thing in your head where you think, well, maybe it'll meet the test of time, maybe it will meet its readers 100 years from now,
and
I really like the way that then, once that test has been put in, all you can really be doing is writing for yourself.
Yeah.
And your push and, like, the challenge that you're making for yourself.
Yeah. I think this was something what was really freeing about that. Like,
all
of a sudden you're like, well, I don't really care about this audience that I'm writing towards. I'm gonna write what I want to write. And if it doesn't, it's that sort of more primal impulse to write.
Yeah.
Like, I think when you start writing, you just want to tell good stories. You want to entertain people. You want to sort of, like, express something that can't be expressed in another way. And then, you've written a few books, and all of a sudden there comes these sort of external pressures of, well, is an agent going to want to represent this? Is a publisher going to want to publish this?
Mm.
And that sort of, all of that stuff seems to some extent, get in the way of the more, holy or sacred impulse to create art, like meaningful art,
Totally.
But that's not to say that, like, the act of writing is this weird.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't want to sort of say that, like, artists are these great people who, because most of them are pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But but I do think there's a sort of, like, there's an innocent motivation to writing that sort of preempts other motivations, and I think as you sort of, try to make a career out of it, that becomes a little bit.
That's so true.
Blurry.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I really you know, like I'm writing at the moment a book that's about the sea, and it's about cetaceans. And you know, I remember while I was reading this book just thinking, why bother? Like, I mean, everything, like, I mean, good God, you know, I'd keep sort of thinking, oh, well, I could take this angle, and then I'd come across a chapter that took that angle, you know, like it just seems so, I don't know what the word is, it's so magnificent, and it is just such, it's just incredible, and it feels like everything that is to be said has been said. And I just wonder, like, I hope this isn't a racist question, no, but and being an American author, like for me, when I came across this book, you know, people used to use it sort of for shorthand as long as, you know, Man's Struggle Against Beast. You know, like people would use it for shorthand as that. And like most of the classics that I've read lately, I had an idea of what the book was like. And then when I read it, it was completely smashed. But I'm just wondering, does it sit, and coming from Boston as well, like does it sit somewhere, like where does it sit? Do you think, like, you can't obviously pretend what it's like to be a New Zealander, but where does it sit, do you think, as an American? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. I mean, I guess it's worthwhile sort of talking about how I came into it, like how I sort of got into it, which is through sort of secondary responses to Moby, to the most sort of obvious and kind of cheesy ones. One is when I was really young, my brother and I watched the movie Jaws the time.
I love Jaws.
And I think, and that movie has sort of elements to it. And I know it was a novel first, and I've read the novel, but I think it's worth just talking about the movie, because I think the movie is a real masterpiece.
It really is.
But it is a sort of micro version of Moby Dick in a lot of ways. You know, people going out to sea with these different identities and conquering this great void, or being conquered by it. And so, like, I think that film, which, I mean, I must have watched it hundreds of times in my youth, and I know line from line what happens in that film. And I spent a lot of time sort of thinking about the characters in that, but I mean, this is when I was, you know, a little kid, but it was a really big work in terms of telling me sort of what narrative is and how you construct characters, and so that sort of that's one thing that led me to Moby Dick. And another thing was I was just thinking about this the other day was Star Trek II.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
The Wrath of Khan, which has all these like great lines from Moby Dick in it, where you know, they're sort of dueling in spaceships, and Khan is he blows up, like, as there's a moment at the end of the film where he's sort of basically quoting the end of Moby Dick line for line, word for word, and I remember loving that scene and the sort of language of it, the sort of "from hell's heart I stab at thee with my last breath," and it's just like, you're like, what? Where is this coming from? And of course it's Moby Dick. And when I was like 8 or 9 or 10, you know, the school that I was going to had a big library, and they had these sort of contemporary classics of you know, abridged versions of you know, Robinson Crusoe, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and they had a Moby Dick one, and I think I must have read that at some point, that abridged version. But I just think one of the reasons, well, not one of the reasons, but one of the things that has been true for me about Moby Dick is it sort of, there's so many things that I've really loved that seem to sort of come back to that.
Yeah,
like I love Jaws, and I sort of I can't imagine Jaws existing without Moby Dick having existed before it, because
I was thinking that while I was reading it, I can't remember what sitcom we were watching, but it was, I can't remember what it was, but it was someone, and I was just like, oh my God, he's Ahab, you know, was, and I just realized that this character of, you know, he's just, his madness is sanity, kind of, you know what I mean? Like, he's so mad that he's crystal clear sane, kind of.
Yeah.
And, like, I just feel like this character echoes through American culture.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, just echoes through it. And I think, I don't know, like, it just, that's what I was really surprised with by the book. Like, I really thought that what I was going to read was some wordy kind of la la la, here we go, da da da. And I think that is what is so incredible about the journey of those first chapters, you know, where I'm like, really? And then there's the amazing sort of Jonah, you know, like in the church, which just, I'm just like, oh, I want to read more of this. And I just, because I think in a lot of ways the book, there were bits that I didn't enjoy at all.
Yeah, no, it's, like, there's parts that are, some of it's really outdated, like some of the science, like this chapter about whale science. They're this kind of fish, and you're like, oh, God. it is really dated, and it's funny, like, those first chapters seem sort of like, it's sort of like if you had a Judd Apatow film, and then like half hour into it, it becomes like a Terrence Malick film, and you're like, whoa, how did that shift occur? And all of a sudden, Seth Rogen is a secondary character, and or maybe Lars von Trier would be a better director comparable, but like, it does seem a really, really strange, jarring transition.
Mm.
And I think it is that sort of the moment in the church
is
sort of the place where the novel suddenly takes on this like broader dimension.
Yeah.
You could almost, it would be interesting to read it with that, like starting in that first chapter, starting at that place, you know, where he's sort of like walking by this church and he sees the sign and he goes in and that would be a very different... Yeah, it does seem very, very manipulative in a weird way, and you wonder if that's. I mean, I sort of read it as that is, you know, he's writing this draft, and that's the moment where, you know, Hawthorne comes in and says, "You should write something great. Yeah. You know, you should strive to write the hardest novel, as opposed to writing just pop bestsellers." But you could also read it as he's trying to lie to his audience and like get him to read the book, and then all of a sudden. You're 80 pages in or 100 pages in. Now I'm gonna throw crazy stuff at you.
Yeah,
because you're hooked.
This is the thing that I found so bizarre and exciting and intriguing, and maybe it shows me as a lazy reader. But as I was reading through, I was thinking, you know, and I have a friend who says the same thing about Infinite Jest. He loves that book so much, but he always says to me, "Could have done with an editor."
Yeah.
You know, like often I read. That's what I was thinking. Like all the way through, I was sort of thinking to myself, you know. Should I, you know, does this bit need going? Does that bit need going? You know, what's the story with it? And yet, when I got to those final chapters, like those ones, you know, the ones at the end, you know, like the end could be its whole, a whole novel in itself. Like it's the first trip out, the second trip out. You know, I just realized that everything, even the bits that I struggled to read over, like the bits that took me, you know, days to fucking wade through, they'd all come to that point. And even the stuff, you know, like in the pub and, you know, all that stuff, all that ho-ho kind of camp over the top stuff at the start. Like, I just realized that there wasn't a word that I would change because of the payoff that comes in those final chapters. And, and that's the thing, is that it feels so like chaotically structured, yet somehow it feels perfectly structured. Is that just me making sense of it? What do you reckon about that?
I think the chaos is the payoff. Like, I think there's something really satisfying about a novel that sort of goes down these rabbit holes time and time again that might not necessarily be pertinent, but add a layers of, like all the details of what it was like to work on a whale ship. I mean, I love that. Yeah. I love, you know, one thing I always tell my students is if you could write about a job, people are fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And he spends so many pages telling us like, oh, this is what how you cut up a whale. This is what it's like to kill a whale. And it's like, and it's so sort of great to have that, to have the sort of sense of. You know, all these component parts working in unison to complete a pretty foul, from our sort of modernist perspective, a pretty foul mission. But like, you know, when they finally get to the point where they're accomplishing their mission, it is really satisfying because you know what everyone's doing and what everyone's thinking and what, like, you know, you don't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah, and that's what I think is so incredible is that, because the... You know, like, you understand... Like, that was what I found really interesting at the end, because I just think one of the master strokes of this that just blow my mind every time is that he seems to write action so incredibly well. Like, that person's there, that person's there. You know, there can be nine different people doing nine different things. Some are in the water, some are still in the boat. The whale's over there, blah, 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 blah. But I do realize that I think a lot of that is the work that's been done earlier. You know, when I understand that this person's job is this, and I've been out on a whale hunt before, and I know that this person's job is that, and da, 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 and I know what's waiting back at the boat, and I know,
you know, how they're feeling about this and how they feel about Ahab, and you know, like, it does seem quite incredible. Do you have, like, I was thinking, for me, when I hear the word Moby Dick now, what I think of is that scene where they're in the boats above the whale nursery and they look down and it's deep, 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 deep. That, and the man falling into the whale. Those are sort of, that's, for me now, that's kind of like my first image is the deep, 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 deep. Do you have an image like that when you think about
I mean, I love the way, there's a moment where he says, well, it's when the character of Pip, I'm talking to Pip. There's a little cabin boy, African-American cabin boy on the ship who falls in the water when they're going out to hunt a whale. And and I think it's Stubbs who's like, well, if you do that again, if you fall out again, we're leaving you behind and killing our whale. And it happens again. He falls out of the boat. They leave him behind. And he's sort of floating in the abyss for a while, and somebody else finally picks him up. But before they, like, by the time they pick him up, he's gone mad. And Melville has this wonderful, like, this is a character who's depicted as being sort of jovial and slightly innocent and slightly naive, and yet Melville sort of describes him as his sort of, his mind descends into the darkness of the water, and he imagines all these sort of, he imagines, like, there's a beautiful line of, like, God having his foot on the I don't know, the spinning wheel of, it's just this, like, incredible, like, moment where this character who's been sort of portrayed in sort of joking, stereotypical ways, all of a sudden is granted a profound interior life that then leaves him, and he comes back and he's mad, and he can't speak, and he's gone to that void. But as Melville's describing that, he says, well, to give you an idea of that, see a ship in the middle of the ocean in very calm waters. When the men go swimming to clean themselves off, see how closely they cling to the sides of the ship. Like, even in the most calm water, if you're in the middle of the ocean and you jump in the ocean, you will stay so close to the side of the ship. And it's true, like, I'm sort of terrified and fascinated by the ocean in equal measure. And I mean, there's something about the sort of the depths of the ocean, and yeah, I don't know. That to me is the most chilling moment of the whole novel.
I remember you saying, while I was reading it, I remember you saying, has that boy fallen out of the boat yet? And I was just like, no. And I think there was another weird thing is, like, this, I don't know, this is probably an insane idea, but, like, it does read almost like science fiction, you know, like, what we call sort of space opera now, you know, like, and it was interesting this morning, I was looking for this book and my China Melville book was up there, and I was like, oh, and I was just thinking, because you've read The Kraken, you really like that book as well, and I was just thinking how, you know, it does, and I was thinking about Gravity as well, you know, like, just that movie, and I was thinking, even when we go to space, we often lean back on this book. Which I think,
well, Wrath of Khan.
Wrath of Khan. I'm so glad you made that thing, because it's so true.
I was just thinking about it the other day. I mean, that was my first sort of, like, direct encounter with lines from the book was Wrath of Khan,
which is just so magnificent, and, like, the lines are so good, and that's the thing, like, as you read it, like, I found as I was reading, I read it at different paces. It's one of those great books as well. There are some chapters that take, you know, like I said, take days to sort of wade through, and then there are others that work really, really fast. And it's really interesting. I follow a Twitter account which is Moby Dick. They're just, like, little tweets from the book. And, like, you do realize that the language is just unbelievable, you know, and the things that it's saying about being human and work and, you know, that realization that the ship is a factory, and it's just quite incredible. And even I was going through this today, and there's even some musing about the fact that they're fishing the whales dry, you know, like the whales,
they realize they keep going further and further away,
which is like, I mean, it's incredible, really, it's incredible. You talked, actually we were talking before we started recording, but the last novel you wrote, it does have an element of kind of religion in it, you know, and I was just wondering, and this sort of has you know, I think abyss is a book that is a word that you that I do associate with that book.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, did you think about this book when you were writing that, or were there other influences for that? Or?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think you can't sort of. I don't know if there's ever going to be a book I can write without thinking on some level about this book. But I do. What I love about this book is it is a sort of. It is a writer who sort of is coming from religion. I mean, my family's Catholic, but I didn't have a particularly religious upbringing, and I'm not particularly religious. But one of the things I like about Moby Dick is it is a sort of a person who was religious coming to terms with the sort of the improbable elements of religion. Like,
yeah.
I think this is one of the interesting sort of subplots of the whole novel is the sort of loss of faith. I don't know if I'm coming to answer your question at all, but I think anybody who writes about American religion, there's a kind of desperation, I guess, to how religion is felt in this novel. And I think that's true, especially in America. Like, I think there's a sort of, I don't want to make broad comments about, like, this is what all religious, everyone who's religious in America feels this way. But I do think there's a degree to which, like, American religious life is lived on a sort of on a razor's edge, and the sort of the precipice on the other side is this sort of is that abyss I think Melville was sort of recognizing and delving into a little bit.
Yeah, because that was the other thing I thought. You told me this other thing about this book. I started noticing that towards the end, there were some images and metaphors of land seeping in, and I think I noticed them because they'd been so absent for the rest of the book. You know, like it really,
yeah.
It feels very watery and oceany and stuff like that. But towards the end, there's the odd dream of a green field or
the hump,
you know,
like a snow hill.
Yes, yeah,
right.
yeah. And you talked about writing from a distance because, of course, this book, I think you said, you'll put me right, because this book was written away from the ocean, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, it was written in the he wrote it in the Berkshires, which is, I think it's about a 4 or 5 hour drive, Mount Greylock. What's the town that his house is in? It's not North Adams, but it's near North Adams. So it's a 4 or 5 hour drive from the ocean now. It must have been a lot longer back then. So he was writing it at a landlocked place. He was writing it at a number of years distant from his experience. He actually did go on a whale ship for a brief period of time. So there is a great deal of distance in this novel. Like he can come at this stuff with a degree of perspective that he might not have brought to his earlier novels.
Because that's what I was thinking about, what you were talking about, like, because the novel you've written is set in America and, you know, deals with kind of issues that I think are very central to Americans. And I'm wondering, you're writing that at a distance, at a remove as well. Do you want to talk about that process? Like, what's that like, writing about, because I know, that's what I always think. I always think, oh, I want to write about the West Coast of America, but I can't write about the West Coast of America unless I'm there, you know?
Right, right.
Whereas what I find, like, last year I was lucky enough to go there, and I couldn't write a fucking thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things I sort of, as I sort of applied for to do the PhD here, I said it would be really nice to write a novel about American life or American tensions far away. Like, I think it would be really useful to sort of imagine that world without being inundated in it. And I think there's something about, this is the thing, whenever I go back home now, whenever I go back to the States, I see it in a really bright way. Like, I see it in this sort of weird, strange clarity of, like, this is so strange and absurd and beautiful and wonderful and awful. And you know, whenever I go back, I'll usually spend 2 weeks just sort of wandering around, like go to Target and just be like dazzled that Target exists in America. Or, you know, drive on the highways and be like, holy cow, everyone goes, I mean, in New Zealand, you never go above 60 miles an hour.
No.
And I think it's wonderful. But like in America, you're constantly, you do that every day. You go 75 miles an hour. I mean, and just that sort of, that speed difference is so startling to go back to. But yeah, I do think it's something really valuable about time and geographic distance. And allowing that sort of, one of my teachers said something about like, you should always write 10 years towards your past. So if you're 25, you can write about what it was like to be 15. And if you're 35, then you can write about what it's like to be 25. And I thought, and I found that's really, really accurate. Like, I think that's a really good, that's a good barometer in general. Like, it's a good rule of thumb to be like, okay, you know, I can write about like, I mean, I'm a new parent now you know, when am I going to write about parenting? Well, I'm not going to try to write about parenting now. I'll wait until they're 10, and then I'll write about what it's like to be a new parent. And then when they're 20, I'll write about them being 10. Or I don't know. But yeah, I do think it's hugely important and really wonderful to have that distance. I think it's one of those, like, there's so many interesting questions you could add, like, spend years doing PhDs on or something. Mm-hmm. Like, I love to spend a chunk of time think about that. Think about like great works and the correlation between great works and proximity to experience. You know, there's so many different works you can think about with that. But
because I know I have this dream for the kind of contemporary novel. Like I'm really interested in the idea of what would happen if we wrote closer to events. Like,
I think
you're right. I think that it's a very tricky thing to do. There's Alan Hollinghurst wrote this incredible book, which was about kind of sort of the history of you know, late gay London, really. Like, right. It was, you know, it was generations of people who had lived in London, lived as, you know, as homosexual men in London. And he stopped writing that as he's written this great essay, and he talks about how he stopped writing that just as his friends were getting sick.
Yeah.
And he completely, you know, that then, you know, I think it was like 3 months after the book was published, you know, the AIDS virus, you know, it just kind of ballooned. And he then wrote another book which was on that. But I just love this idea that we have no idea what's going to be important in the future and what's not.
Right.
But I think, and I don't know the degree of success you can do that to. Like, I don't know. But
I think too, there's a sort of, you know, how literature, fiction, addresses a particular scenario or circumstance or event that takes place is different than how other things communicate that event. So I mean, I think like the most obvious sort of cliched example would be like September 11th in the States. Like, you know, when is it appropriate to write novels about that?
Yeah.
Well, we have enough like real stories about that to process through before we need to write novels about it, you know? And I think that's another benefit of that sort of that time, that distance thing, is I think a novel is a thing that deals with ambiguities, deals with complicated issues, and I think, you know, there's a time for that, and it's not necessarily the time, like, it's not necessarily the right time to deal with it immediately. And you can look at it sort of, I mean, that's looking at it from the point of view of an event that happens, but you can also look at it interiorly,
in
your life, like, is it, you know, do you want to write about that bad breakup you had with that girlfriend the week after it happens, or do you want to write it 10 years later? Well, the better book is going to be the book you write 10 years later, because, you know, the book you write the week afterwards is going to be pretty damn one-sided and pretty unpleasant to read for everybody.
Because I know that I even look back at some of the stories in my short story collection, and they were written very close, and a lot of them are about Tallulah because she was young, and a lot of them are about parenting, and they're very difficult to read now because, like, I know Tallulah better, you know, I've known Tallulah for another 8 years, you know, 6 or 7 years, Brent and my relationship shifted, you know, and it is, you know, these ideas that I held very strongly and fervently have kind of grayed out a little bit in time, and I think you're right. I think a novel or a story, you do need that degree of ambiguity, and I think that's Yeah, I think that is what time definitely gives us,
right.
You know, and,
right.
and I think distance. I was really interested in what you said about going back to America, and I was thinking about Sarah Bainbridge has just arrived.
Oh, very good.
Hello. She just walked past our window. I was thinking about when we were in America, we were not there for that long. I think we were there for 8 weeks. But I always felt slightly wrong. Like I always felt, and the thing is that I feel like I've been drenched in American culture.
Sure.
But I always felt slightly impolite. I always felt like I was wearing the wrong clothes. Mm. I kind of felt like my hair was wrong. You know, like I just had this strange experience. And when I went to get on the airplane coming back to Air New Zealand, you know, on Air New Zealand, coming back to New Zealand, I looked around and I thought, holy mackerel, there's a huge cultural difference between these New Zealanders look strange. You know, like they,
yeah.
we were all wearing dark colors. Right. You know, there were just things. And I just knew these were New Zealanders. And I imagine there's something about the distance that makes home odd when you get
yeah.
back there, right?
Yeah.
Like, because you talked about, because like, I think last time you were there, you were talking about going to Target and buying, are those called Twizzlers? Those little orange, you know, like, getting
sort of red licorice.
Yeah,
yeah
red licorice
sure.
things. And I guess, yeah, it'll, I think, yeah, I don't know, what I think I'm just agreeing with what you said.
Yeah. I don't know, it's strange to sort of come back to New Zealand after that and then to sort of, because then you come back here and like I remember the first few months I was living here and just being staggered by how strange it was.
Yeah.
I mean the small strange.
Yeah.
I mean
yeah.
there's a lot of commonalities between the
yeah.
two countries and it's not like
yeah.
you know it's Nepal versus the United States. I mean it's a pretty mm. comparable place. But I just remember sort of walking around in a daze and being awed by everything and
mm.
how sort of like green and rainy and cold it was in July and. And just how like people choose to live, where they choose to build houses, what houses look like, just slightly different and slightly askew from what I was used to.
Mm.
But now when I come back, it is a sort of like I don't see it as differently as I used to. Like I think I see America in a brighter way than
yeah.
I see New Zealand, which is strange. But
yeah, because I was thinking, you know, like Melville. Travel, like he did not spend a lot of time, you know, like he was
yeah.
moving around. And I was thinking you've done that as well, eh? Like you've lived in Nepal.
No, I didn't live there. I visited.
Yeah. But
my partner lived there for a
yeah,
long time.
Yeah. But you have traveled quite a bit, eh? Like, do you think travel's important for writing? That's such a glib, stupid question. Like, do you think travel's important for writing? But, like, do you think that it's vital? Do you think...
Oh, no, I hate sort of... I was thinking about Edward P. Jones. I saw Edward P. Jones sort of give a talk. And he's you know, he's an American novelist.
Yeah.
Written some, a great novel and a great story collection. And he wrote them in the sort of basement of his house.
Mm.
And he was working. He was like a data entry person.
Yeah.
And that's how he made his living. He'd work like 40 hours a week just entering data into his computer and then writing a novel. And he wrote this beautiful novel.
Mm.
And I think he... Yeah, I mean, it's nice to say, I mean, travel's nice, but I don't
yeah.
necessarily think it's a sort of a necessary component to being like oh, this will deepen your experience. I mean, you know, you can travel and see the world differently. You can travel, I mean, my travels in, say, third world countries were mostly like me sitting in a hotel room
yeah.
watching fuzzy television and being grateful that I was, you know... had a door to close and clean water to drink.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, it's great if you can do it. If you have the sort of, like, the guts to be a sort of intrepid traveler,
yeah.
like in the sort of Hemingway mold of,
yeah.
I'm going to sip deeply from the cup of life and have great adventures and shoot, you know, animals in Africa, then great. Like, that's wonderful. But I think if you, you know, if you want to sort of sit in the basement and do data processing, you can still write a beautiful novel.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's an essential
yeah.
component of things. I mean, I've enjoyed it. Like, I've enjoyed living here.
Yeah.
And it's been really nice to live here. But I do think I've gotten something out of, like, all
yeah.
the places I've lived.
Yeah.
And all the places I've visited. But I don't necessarily think it's a prerequisite to being
yeah.
a, like, I don't think, oh, this writer is better than that writer because
yeah.
his passport is more sort of, is thicker.
Because that was kind of what I did. I did this thing towards the end of the book where I was feeling a bit depressed because I was thinking, I've never been anywhere, you know, like, oh my god,
and honestly, this experience that's the other thing that sort of drives me nuts about Moby Dick is like, I would, if I had been alive in that time, like, it makes me sad that I was not alive to sign up to just wander down to the docks and sign up and hop on a whale ship. And granted, you know, a lot of people died, a lot of people didn't get paid anything, it was miserable, but like, how amazing a time was that you could just sort of like, if you're, I mean, and granted, you know, this is, I'm speaking this as a man, because there weren't a lot of women on these ships, but how amazing was it that, like, in that era, you could choose to do that? You could be like, well, you know, I don't have a lot of luck, and so I'm going to just see the world on the back of a ship and travel and see exotic places. And it sort of pains me, because I think I would, like, if I had been alive in that time, I would be like, yeah, sign me the hell up, man. That sounds amazing. What fun that would be.
How would that? You're way braver than me. I just...
I say that, and I probably wouldn't.
Yeah, I just loved... that is one of the things. I like what you said about a job. You know, one of my favorite things about this book is that it's about working. You know what I mean? Like, it really is about work, and it's about... You know, and I realized really early on that it is... It makes odd, again, you know, like, it's about hunting these huge animals. Yep. Like, that is what it's about. It's about, and it just seems like such an odd, odd thing.
Mm-hmm. There's another one of my favorite parts of the book is when I think it's the Stubbs of Starbucks is killing the whale, and at the end of, like, they bring the whale next to the ship, and they have to sort of, they take this long lance and dig it into the heart, and they have to, like, catch the heart, and then it'll blow, when it blows out air, it'll blow out blood. And so there's this wonderful, I mean, it's poetic and haunting and terrifying, and it's just like he's looking for, as if he's like dropped a key down a hole, and he's like stabbing into this great giant thing, trying to find this little bit so he can nick it, and then everything goes to hell, and like blood shoots out of everything, and he's like, oh, there we go. And then one of the, is this like really wonderful moment of humor where one of them's like, yep, looks like he got it, and they're like, oh my god. Like, they're all, you can just sort of imagine them all like sort of drenched in blood, and like sharks circling the fish and or the whale, and you're like,
there wasn't another so day much in the office. There was, that's what I thought over and over again. I was like, oh, another day in the office. No, it's bloody great. Hey, I don't think I've got any more questions. Is there anything else you want to say about Moby Dick? I think we've had a good what's the word I'm looking at? I think we've had a good stab at it.
I'll say one more thing about Moby Dick, which is that, like, when I sort of at one moment in my life, I was sort of really nervous about point of view and like how to sort of tell a story on point of view. And one of the things I love about Moby Dick is it just completely like leaves that question in the dust. Like he's like, oh, I'm going to tell a story from Ishmael. Call me Ishmael, and we start with this one character. And then, you know, there's moments in the book where all of a sudden that character disappears, and we're like listening to a play between two characters. And for me, that was, you know, that was one of those moments, like, it was one of those moments where a novel can sort of answer a question you've struggled with for a long time. Like, it doesn't have to matter that you're maintaining a consistent point of view. And that's not to say that, like, all novels should just blow things up all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I remember, I think I spent, like, 5 years of my life being really anxious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then encountering Moby Dick and being like, oh, right, it doesn't matter. Like, the rules are not rules. And you can do whatever you want with fiction. And I think that's... For me, one of the things that Moby Dick has sort of answered in sort of elemental craft area is point of view can be whatever you want it to be, and you know, you control your novel, and you can have it go whatever direction you want it to go in. And I'm so grateful that he took those sort of bold choices.
Because I was thinking that I was hearing that Raymond Carver quote yesterday about no tricks, you know, the only rule is no tricks, and I feel like that with this book, you know, like it doesn't feel like there's tricks, and and that thing you're saying about placing the narrator or whatever that is, but because I remember there is a scene out in the boats where I suddenly thought, how the hell did we end here? You know, this seems like a narrator that's Eye of God but talking from the future, but you know, it's not Ishmael anymore. We're not with any of the other characters I think I know. And I looked back to where we'd, you know, I thought, what amazing thing did he do to make that happen? And I looked back and all he did was just change. Like, I think it may have even been mid-paragraph or something. And it was just like, okay.
Yep.
You know, and I think you're right. Like, I feel like that with this book as well. It's like, I sort of have that idea of, oh, you know, the way that someone, like the way that it mixes nonfiction, it throws everything, you know, like we've got all these ideas about what something should look like, and if you're going to move point of view, you better have a good reason and you better do it in a tricky way. Right. You know, you better have stars or, you know,
some indication to the audience.
But it just wasn't a problem.
Well, I think it's the other great thing is that, like, Melville assumes that the audience is smart. Like it's a thing of, like, are you going to be a writer who makes sure your audience is following you every step of the way, or are you going to be a writer who trusts that your audience will have the capacity to follow through? And it's so much more satisfying to read a novel in which the author has faith in your intelligence and has faith in your capacity to go with them on these these, when they make these broad steps and these weird swerves. And and I think
because that, I mean, that is the I don't know, like, I keep you know, I just keep loving the fact that this book, like, it seems to have the audience in mind. Like, it seems to come from a writer that understands what people want, but also has this disregard. It's kind of that thing of giving you what you need rather than what you want. Do you know what I mean? Like, you didn't know you wanted it until you read it, kind of stuff, which I just find quite amazing. And you know, brave and ballsy and,
It's also a novel that, like, there's nothing he's holding back. Like,
there's not
like a story he's saving for the next novel. And I think that's so great too, to sort of, because I'm always sort of thinking about, well, what am I going to write about if I write this book? And you sort of, I mean, I was thinking about, like, Ivor McBride's novel, A Girl Is a Curious Thing, which is another, like, a sort of modern novel or a recent novel that I think is an example of that, where an author sort of puts everything they have into a novel. And one of the things that sort of, if you read the reviews of that novel, they come back to is, what's she going to do as a follow-up? And I'm like, I don't care. Like, you've created this great a novel. It does it, like, you could write no other books, but you've written that book. And you've gone to that place. And I think that's what sort of, I mean, I think it's a great thing about Moby Dick is that it is a writer sort of operating at full throttle and not holding anything back for something else and not sort of sacrificing anything.
Because I just remember that last page and just thinking, I felt spent, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was just like, fuck, you know, and it was just, and like you say, there's nothing, you know, it's all, there's nothing left back. And I think, I don't know. Oh, it's a magnificent book. How do you recommend this book to people? Do you recommend this book? Like, when you talked about talking to your students about it. Like,
I don't know if I've ever recommended Melville. I mean, I think he's... honestly, like, for me, a big part of, like, why it's interesting is because I always wanted to sort of, like... I've always been fascinated by whales. I've always wanted to be, like... When I was a kid, I always wanted to study whales. And I also always wanted to be a writer. So for me, it ticks off two big boxes for me. And it also sort of references... there's a lot of scenes in Massachusetts, which is where I'm from.
Yeah.
And so it has a geographic proximity to where I've lived. So it's right in my wheelhouse for a lot of ways. Yeah. But I don't often... like, I don't think I ever sort of say to anybody, oh, you should... Like, I feel like that would be a real... That's a real tough one to say.
You mentioned Montreal, and I was thinking I feel the same way as that. I really loved Antichrist. Do you love Antichrist? I feel the same way, and I found myself getting quite sort of, I feel the same, you know, like, I, you know, the whale thing, it ticked off the whale thing, it ticked off the non-linear, you know, it ticked off a lot of the structure things, and I must admit that I, you know, people would see me reading it, and they're like, oh, what's that like? And I'm like, oh, it's all right, don't think you'd like it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the comparables that I have, I remember finally seeing Casablanca for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, I saw it, it was, like, being played at a Summer in the Park thing somewhere, and I finally saw it, I was maybe 28 years old, and I had never seen Casablanca before, as I was watching it, I was like, oh my god, that's where this comes from. Like, I suddenly saw, like, all the references, all the times the Simpsons had referenced Casablanca, or other films had made nods to that film, and I think Moby Dick's the same thing. It's like, one of the satisfying things about reading it is you realize how saturated our culture is from that, like, how much of American storytelling and how much of American art has sort of come from that and descended from that. And I think, and so that, I mean, that is a satisfying reason to read Moby Dick, is to be like, oh, right, that's where all this comes from.
Because I was watching True Detective started just as I was finishing the book, and I remember thinking, Rust! What does Ahab?
Yeah, you know.
And I think, and yeah,
I mean, almost every like almost every American great television character can be like as Tony Soprano, Ahab, Breaking Bad, Ahab.
Yeah,
like, there's a real like it, it's a it, you know there's so many sort of it's stuck deep in the culture, but it's
No, it's a fantastic read, and I need to thank you again for getting me to get it out and read it through. And
you're the only person I've recommended it to, so maybe
there you go. Yeah, you should start. People will love it. They love it. We're going to go back out in the storm. The storm has not abated. Is that the right word?
I think it has abated a little bit. It's not as windy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pip.